It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to. Lots to talk about. Woke up this morning to a bipartisan infrastructure deal on the rocks. In fact, the headlines everywhere you looked, infrastructure talks at risk of collapse. Last minute partisan disputes threaten infrastructure. Infrastructure bill negotiators try to overcome late minute hurdles. Bipartisan infrastructure talks on the brink. Senate negotiators at odds. Infrastructure bill stalls as GOP rejects offer from Democrats. And you go, yeah, I could go on. There are hundreds of these, every publication across the board, saying what we knew months ago. Republicans are never going to vote for an infrastructure bill. It's not going to happen. Charlie Brown, stop running at the football. You're never going to kick it. You need to walk up, grab the ball from her, and then kick it. And this is I'm not saying Democrats are stupid. They know that this is the MO. They get this, I hope. But at some level, you got to go, we're in charge. We Piggy's got the conch. We've got the power to do something. Do it. This is what leadership is. You have the keys, drive the car. And, you know, what's frustrating to me is we've watched this play out over and over. This is the game that has played out, you know, for decades now. Democrats have an agenda they want to move, and Republicans say, no, we're not going to do it. Nothing for you. And it's the same bad sequel over and over and over. And Democrats hope, you know, they hope that the GOP will work in bipartisanship, you know, like they did back in the old days. When Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill used to sip whiskey and smoke cigars. Ah, the good old days. Back when, you know, George H.W. Bush signed the Americans with Disability Act. Today, 31 years ago. Ah, the good old days. Problem is, Republicans now are willing to watch Rome burn. Because they know that disaster capitalism is good for them. Disaster capitalism means government is the problem. You know, their bumper sticker policy making, government's the problem. The public sector is the problem. We need the private sector. And this plays right into their frame. If they can get nothing done, things crumble around. You go, see, look, government can't do anything. This is why we need the profit. We need Wall Street. And the thing that's weird to me is while we keep wishing, you know, in one hand, that we can get effective government to meet our needs and get the things that we need to get done. The other is filling up with steaming piles of you-know-what. And to be honest, this makes corporate America very happy. Very happy, because status quo, good for the very wealthy who have funded and lobbied for where we are in this moment. Our incredible dependence on the captains and titans of industry. The likes of Amazon, the likes of Walmart, Google, they're thrilled because there's no one holding them accountable. No one. And that's why when I saw this story over the weekend, last week we had Alex Press on the program from Jacobin Magazine. And she wrote a great piece on basically the new company store. And how Amazon, and I've talked about this at length before, and if you want to check out the interview with Alex Press from last week, you can go to our YouTube page. But I'm reading this article, and I'm going, yep, this is, you know, stuff we've been talking about for a while. The idea that you get the Amazons or even the Walmarts to come in and you give them whatever they want. We need the jobs. So there's a big giant ribbon cutting ceremony. Oh, we're bringing X amount of jobs to the neighborhood. Oh, this is great. The newspaper's covering this. Oh, this is fabulous. Walmart's coming to town, going to bring jobs. Yay. They don't really talk about the massive amounts of government subsidy that goes into it. The giving away of, you know, utilities and land and, you know, all kinds of stuff. We give the baby the bathwater, the bucket, the spigot, the whole thing. We give it all away to get these moments. And when they come in, they destroy everything else. And this isn't new. I mean, this goes back 100 years to Sears and Roebuck. The same thing. The newest, latest, greatest scheme that pops up destroys everything else. You know, Walmart was doing it. Now Amazon is outdoing Walmart. But her argument is that this is bad. But we can deal with it. We can do something about it. And this is where I keep coming back to my belief in we the people. What's frustrating about Amazon is if you remember the big H2Q a-thon that went on where they went across the country, I think there were like 250 plus cities that did a whole bunch of really extensive research on their demographics and on their positioning and all kinds of stuff that corporate America would generally spend money having their own research people do. But we did it for free because we wanted those jobs. We wanted those headquarters. And look, Pittsburgh was never getting it. Dubuque was never getting it. There were cities across this country never getting it. But they thought they had a chance. And Amazon was courting that. Give us all your information. Give us your data. And the headquarters went exactly where everybody thought it was going to go. New York and Washington. Because that's where the power and the population is. Now the people of New York wised up and they did move that out of there. Somewhat, but they got all this free information and they became the centers of the community and ended up crushing virtually everything else. And the argument that she's making in this is that, you know, they're now setting what the working class norms are, where this is the new company town where families are working in these Amazon place, these Amazon warehouses, you know, part-time, usually seasonal. They're in and out. It's this kind of, and everybody can come in and get a job there. And they usually just churn through people at an incredible rate. I think the numbers that she cited was like for every one person that comes and stays, there's like five or I think there's like eight that don't. So they got to hire eight people to get one person to come do actual work. Because the churn and the stress and everything that goes in this is so all-encompassing. And what Amazon has done, and masterfully, to their credit, look, if you've got a government who's going to go, yeah, go ahead, monopolize, own everything, then they're going to do that. And in such a very short time, Amazon has figured out how to dominate virtually everything that we do. In fact, you know, we bought a camera the other day. And we went to the store, went to Best Buy, bought this camera, and we find out that it's an Amazon company. I'm going, you can't get away from them. They're literally everywhere. And it's because of we have a government that's broken. But the argument that she's making in this, if I'm getting this right, is that, you know, the company town had a socialization and a way of building, making a working class. You were desperate on the company store. You were desperate for the jobs that they got. You were desperate for the housing and the health care. And I've argued this has been going on for a while. We've created a working class that is basically in the company store, only we've done it digitally. You're no longer living in company housing and having to see the company doctor, but you're at the will and behest of the company because they control basically your existence. And one of the reasons that I talk often about ending at-will employment and people joining unions is because at any minute, they can pull that away, making you even more desperate. And you know that. So when you know that, you're not willing to stand up and fight, or you're not willing to even speak out because you're afraid for your existence, right where corporate America wants us. But she also talked about what's going on in communities across the country. And she went out to California and pointed out one of these high schools that has a program in the school that trains the next generation of Amazon workers. Kind of like the old factory town high schools, kind of like the old company town schools that were training you specifically to be coal miners. That's what you're going to be. That's it. And using that one opportunity that kids have to make their lives better, to turn them into little brainwashed Amazonites. All complete with, you know, the classroom being adorned with customer obsession, deliver results, you know, the 14 leadership principles of Amazon all over, all in their little golf shirts with the little smiley face on it. Get them young, indoctrinate them young, the beloved Amazon. And the thing that's interesting to me is, and I love the way Alex, you know, turns this and goes, look, you know, they're doing everything they can do to get us to be, to identify with the company store. But as she writes, where a culture of resistance and organization to emerge, it could become something quite different. Warehouses as a site of struggle and consternation and solidarity. She writes, and Amazon as object of scrutiny, an enemy. Instead of the savior coming in to save our community and create jobs and give us that $15 an hour wage, that if you look at warehouse jobs across this country, $15 is actually really low. She writes, there are currently people both inside and outside of warehouses working towards the latter outcome, and even the likes of Jeff Bezos can't stop them. She uses a Thompson quote. She's right, as a noted historian of a different era put it, the working class did not rise like the sun at an appointed time. It was present at its own making. She says it still is. And with each shift, it is remade anew. Whether that will lead to despair, militancy, or something else entirely remains to be seen. So I've been saying for a long time, the working class of this country eventually at some point has to say, enough. We're not taking the long hours. We're not taking the poverty wages. We're not taking the stressful desperation conditions. Not doing it anymore. We're not there yet. Because I look at just what happened out in Kansas, and we've been talking for a while about the Frito-Lay strike out in Topeka, Kansas, and the working conditions that these people toiled under. They were working 7 days a week, 12-hour days. They had to go on strike. Now, understand, they had 84-hour work weeks. They had to go on strike for 3 weeks, put their families' existence on the line, put their jobs on the line, so that they could get a contract that says they only have to work 72 hours in a week. I'm missing something when that's the big win. Oh, you only have to work 6 days a week, 12 hours a day. When I know the history of this country and the history of the labor movement was bloody and violent to get people to work an eight-hour day. And this is where we've given corporations way too much power. We've allowed corporate America to suppress wages to the point where you now have to work 70, 80 hours a week just to exist. And for me, it comes back to policy did all this. Policy can undo it. But it comes back to a militant working class of actual voters, people who are willing to show up and cast their ballot and say, we're not taking this anymore. You know, on our weekend show, you know, someone, you know, took me to task over my support of Joe Biden. And look, I think Joe Biden's the best chance we've had in a while to get major comprehensive labor law reform. He's not the end all be all. I think you have to push. I think you have to get out in the streets. I think you have to organize and demand. And I think he's willing to listen. But it also comes back down to how our political system is broken. And we've got Democrats who just, for one reason or another, they're stuck to the past. And the struggle is, without us pushing them, do you think they're going to do the right thing? Without a militant working class who's tired of what we've gotten, 40 plus years of stagnant and declining wages, benefits that are virtually non-existent, and the kind of stress and the kind of instability that causes great harm to families and to individuals. At some point, do we not say enough is enough? Or has the Amazons of the world done such a good job, done such an incredibly good job of convincing us that this is the best we deserve? That this is all we're worth. That they're part of something bigger. The United Corporation of Amazon. While having your entire family work in the facility at one point or another, dependent entirely on that. Your education system sweeping over to training little Amazonian workers. Also, the Jeff Bezoses of the world can go play with their toys in space, can build a big bathtub boat for $500 million. Is that where we are? And it's just not Amazon. You know, it's all across the country. And I've been reading more and more stories of employers who are supposedly desperate for workers. You hear this all the time. Oh, we're desperate. There's a labor shortage. And yet you've got tons of these companies out there going, no, we'll come work for us. We'll train you. You'll have to pay for it. And you'll pay for it by signing yourself into indentured servitude. But we'll pay for it. You want to learn to be a truck driver? Come sign on, work here for 2 years, and you can become a truck driver. Promise to stay here for 5 years, and you can learn to do whatever. And we see these things popping up all over the place. Whatever happened to the companies needing employees and taking them and training them from the bottom up? There was a brief time in history where that happened. We're now changing our entire educational system to just be, we're going to get a job. It's no longer about building critical thinkers or good citizens. It's about how you're going to get that job. We've got college students who aren't thinking about how to make the world better, thinking about, hey, how can we manipulate the system to make our millions? How can we come up with the next scheme that's going to make us the next Jeff Bezos while simultaneously stepping all over each other so none of us get there? I hope she's right. I hope the remaking of the working class, I'm hoping that is happening right now as people are standing in parking lots and you know, discussing things in the break room. I'm hoping there's that kernel, that seed of we're not going to take this anymore. You know, from the movie Network, you know, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. Are you mad as hell? You going to take it anymore? I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Gonna take a quick break right back after this. Stick around.
There's nothing more American than workers standing up, and the union gives a voice to win on The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1918. That was the day miners' president Ginger Goodwin was shot dead in British Columbia. His murder sparked Canada's first general strike in Vancouver the following week. Goodwin had arrived in British Columbia 8 years earlier and found work in the Cumberland Mines on Vancouver Island. He considered working conditions in the mines absolutely appalling and began advocating for safety and organizing miners. He was soon blacklisted after participating in a 2-year coal miners' strike for recognition on the island. He moved to Trail, British Columbia, where he emerged as a Socialist Party candidate in the 1916 election. He was also elected president of the International Union of Mine, Mill and Smelter Workers, District 6, the vice president of British Columbia's Federation of Labor, and the head of the local Trades and Labor Council. He openly expressed his opposition to Canada's entry into the war, stating that workers were now employed in killing each other. He was found unfit for military duty after a medical exam. That was until he led a strike for the 8-hour day at Consolidated Mining and Smelting. It was the world's largest lead and zinc smelter and a key munitions producer during the war. His status was quickly changed to make him eligible for conscription. He fled to the Cumberland Hills, where he hid out for months to avoid the draft. And on this day, Goodwin was shot dead by a Dominion Police special constable. He was brought back to Cumberland, where thousands turned out for his funeral in a mile-long procession. The Vancouver labor movement was outraged by Goodwin's murder and called a one-day general strike on August 2nd to protest his killing. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in Two.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So it was 31 years ago today that Republican President George Herbert Walker Bush signed the Americans with Disabilities Act into law. And I remember this day. I actually remember it pretty well because I remember my conservative friends at the time going, this is the end of the world. It's all over. Businesses are going to go under. They're never going to be able to comply. It's going to be horrible. It's Armageddon. It's the end. It's going to bankrupt the country. We're all going to be standing on the corner with the ramp accessible sidewalks, and nobody's going to have a job. Well, here we are 31 years later, and I don't see the I missed the end of the world, and I didn't sleep through it. But here to share some thoughts on what did actually happen, because it wasn't the end of the world. I've asked Mia Ives-Rubley to come talk with us. Mia is the director of the Disability Justice Initiative. They're at the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org, their website. Mia, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, man, thank you so much for having me on.
So I'm sure you've heard this frame. It's going to be the end of the world. We can't possibly comply with all of these demands. It's terrible, terrible.
Yes. You know, the sky is falling, et cetera. I just want to sort of age you for a second. I do not remember the ADA being passed. I was 6 years old when it was passed.
Yeah, I remember. You know, and look, I'm old, so I get that. And I remember, you know, George H.W. Bush signing this and not believing that it was actually going to happen. Mm-hmm. I was actually surprised that a Republican president would sign it. And there was some bipartisan support. I look at it now, there's no way in a cold day in Hades that you are going to get a Republican. At least, I don't think you get one Republican to sign on to this at this moment.
Probably, I don't know.
That's just my view, because we're so, so divided. And something like this seems like common sense. We want people to be able to get around. We want people to have the best opportunities they can possibly have. And I don't think some of the things that it required were all that onerous. Things that now we take for granted. I mean, I go to a sidewalk that on the corner doesn't have, you know, the thing that I can ride my bike up and down. I'm going, why isn't this wrong? Get this fixed. I mean, we've now taken a lot of that stuff for granted. It's now who mm-hmm. we are.
Yeah. A lot of the things that are, you know, implemented through the Americans with Disabilities Act are what we term in the disability community as curb cuts, because of the fact that the items, the sort of accommodations that are created are now super helpful for everybody in the United States and even abroad. So yeah, there's quite a few things, not only just curb cuts, but elevators. We look at automatic doors that everybody loves, particularly because of COVID now, and nobody wants to touch anything. So there's a lot of benefits that the ADA has created that a lot of people don't understand. And are extremely important in the United States today.
Right.
You think of COVID, right? And you think of all the people who are working from home now. And a lot of those accommodations were created because of disabled workers who needed a way to be able to work remotely.
Right. And, you know, this isn't just about curb cutouts and about, you know, making, you know, businesses more accessible. This is about jobs. This is about opportunity. Mm-hmm. This is about livelihoods and the reasonable accommodations that employers should have to make to help people. And that doesn't seem too onerous to me. I know there are some extreme cases that my conservative friends love to throw out. But for the most part, it's just making reasonable accommodations to help people. And look, as all of us are getting a little bit older, you start looking at this going, you know, 31 years ago, it wasn't that big of a deal. You start looking at it now down the road, maybe another 10 years, you go, I may need that. So we all may need that at some point.
Yes, definitely. Definitely. I think one thing that people don't realize is that like 1 in 4 people in the United States are actually protected under the Americans with Disabilities Act. And so, you know, and that's just counting right now. And we're looking at the boomer generation. Particularly people with long haul COVID, all of these individuals will be protected under the ADA. And I think, you know, a lot of folks don't realize what these protections mean, whether they're aging at their job and they feel like they're going to be discriminated against because maybe they need more accommodations at their workplace. And I think, you know, it's very beneficial to understand this sort of set of laws that protect folks, particularly when looking at employment.
Yeah. Now, the president did today say that they're going to look at the long term effects of COVID, the long haul folks that you said, and that could be considered a disability under the ADA. And I got to tell you, my first reaction was negative. Mm-hmm. My first thought was, and hear me out, everyone who before today had COVID, we should be taken care of because you didn't have a choice. There weren't a lot of options for you. If you got it and you have the symptoms and the long haul problems, we should be helping. Anyone after a certain date, when the vaccine is available and you chose to go, no, I'm not doing it, and then you got sick, I'm losing sympathy for people who do dumb things. Help me on why I should support the idea of this for everybody and not just saying, hey, you know, after such and such a date, if you don't get the vaccine, nothing for you. In fact, no health care for you. You did this to yourself. You're responsible. You take it on. Why am I wrong?
Why you're wrong is because that I, you know, in general, believe that everybody deserves health care, no matter what choices that they make. And in particular, understanding that not helping individuals is actually going to hurt the general economy and hurt the communities that these people live in. I think that it's an understanding that even if an individual does choose not to get the vaccine, and that may be because of personal reasons, it may be because of issues with healthcare issues.
Or it could just be you're stupid.
Access. I would say there's a lot of misinformation that is going around, and that unfortunately is affecting people's judgment. And I would say, you know, in general, we're talking about a public health issue and a public health crisis. And even if we say that, you know, we will leave out specific population, that's going to affect the broader population. And we really have to look at this as a general public health issue.
See, there you go with your logic again. It just seems better to be reactionary and say, you know what, if you're too stupid to get covered, shame on you. You chose it. If you took the axe and chopped off your own hand, that's you. But here you go with your logic again, turning it around on me. But here's the thing, and this is where I look at this and I go, you know, we should be protecting people who have disabilities, because someday I may have one. But what do you say to the person who goes, you know what, now you're including COVID, now you're including all this stuff. Again, back to the argument 31 years ago, we really can't afford it.
I think that's a fallacy. You know, we have quite a bit of money in the coffers, and I think that it's just generally trying to decide what is most important in our budget, right? Our budget is a moral document, and we have to make a decision on what's going to benefit the people in the United States the most. And that means taking care of the folks that are most marginalized to help uplift the general population. Because if we help the most marginalized within the communities that we live in, we are going to help everybody. I think that's something that's very important for folks to know, is that the disability community is an extremely, extremely important part of our communities. They are individuals who are intelligent. They are individuals who are creative, passionate, driven individuals who are often facing numerous barriers to getting employment, to being able to get healthcare, to being able to get education. And to be able to uplift this part of the community will help the general population. It will help ensure that less folks fall behind, and we have similar crises of these astronomical proportions of, you know, homeless individuals, and other issues that are happening in our society today.
Now, Mia, you said you aged me, you age shamed me a minute ago by saying, you know, you don't remember it, but, you know, you look back at the history of the ADA, you know, what difference would your life have been had we not 31 years ago decided to pass this? What opportunities would you have had as someone who has disabilities? You know, what would your life have looked like today? I don't think you'd be running the Disability Justice Initiative there at the Center for American Progress, but I don't know that. Where do you think you would have been?
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting thought process because what we like to, in the disability community, we term ourselves as the ADA generation because we're individuals who were born and raised sort of with the ADA already in place, right? So we're individuals who have already had the privilege of understanding that we have basic human rights. And before the ADA, that was not the case in terms of our U.S. government, right? We didn't have the basic right to vote. We didn't have the basic right to, you know, do quite a bit within our communities. And so for me, as an individual who grew up with that understanding, I think it provided me with a template to understand that I was going to go to college, that I was going to get an education, that I was going to get a job afterwards. I think, unfortunately, as an individual with a significant disability, I would be facing a headwind to be able to get where I am today. And that could have meant that I would have been institutionalized, which, let me just say, there's still quite a few people that are still institutionalized today. But as for me, I would have likely been institutionalized as an adult and not been given the opportunities to get to where I am today. No.
No, I mean, that's a great thing and good on you for the work that you've done. So then the question then becomes of, you know, you've moved the ball a little bit forward, the past generation opened some doors for you. What's next? Is there a way to make this better? Do you think we're at a significant point? Where do you see the future?
I think what folks need to understand is the ADA is the floor and not the ceiling. So folks need to understand that, yes, we now have this basic framework of understanding that disabled people have human rights. They have specific rights, particularly around public accommodations, employment, telecommunications, et cetera, right? But what we need to start understanding is that there are systems in place that make it hard to get even these basic foundations sort of established. So things that we need to address disability poverty and the poverty trap. So that means addressing system sort of safety net programs like SSI, like SSDI, to ensure disabled people are able to utilize those programs to be able to bounce up into and out of bounce out of poverty, right? So we need to address programs like that require asset limits, that which basically means that you can't save, that provide a basic standard of living that's under the poverty line, right? Individuals who get the basic payment is $794, I believe, per month, which doesn't even afford you rent in any state across the United States, right? The basic rent, I believe, the average rent for one bedroom apartment across the United States is a little over $1,000. So that's not going to cover your basic rent. And then we're talking about copays for health, you know, going to the doctors. We're talking about food. We're talking about other maintenance issues that you need to pay. So really addressing those programs is a significant thing that we need to deal with. Also, there's a little tiny program called 14C, which is in the Fair Wages and Hours, which basically states that individuals with disabilities can be paid below minimum wage.
Right.
And so that means that companies are allowed to pay people literally cents on the dollar. It's literally, you know, sweatshop rates, right? That the average payment on 14C is $2.15 an hour. And that is literally trapping individuals with disabilities in poverty.
Yeah, I think you make more in prison than that.
Yeah, yeah. And so what we are literally saying is that we need to make sure that this program goes out of business and that individuals are paid their fair wages.
Yeah.
And so those are some of the examples that we can do to ensure that disabled people can get out of poverty and can establish real lives in the United States.
Yeah, I mean, good on us for getting to where we are, but there's still work yet to be done.
Yes, definitely.
And I look at this, and you know, again, I give George H.W. Bush credit, you know, that some things he did that I thought were good, and this is one of those. This is one of those things that I thought was important, mm-hmm. and I think making it better down the road is important. Because, look, you know, any one of us, something can happen at any minute that would put us in a negative situation, and which is why I think we need to have these safety nets in place to help catch us. I appreciate you taking time for us and sharing some thoughts on this. Always great talking with you. I wish you the best. I hope you come back and talk to us again real soon.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Good stuff, as always. Mia Ives-Rubley, she's the director of the Disability Justice Initiative there at the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org, their website. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Do you think expanding this is something we can do, something we should do? Or again, do we go back to where when I was a kid, it's the end of the world. It's going to bankrupt all of us, and we're going to all be standing on the corner with no jobs, but at least we'll have ramps. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. You'll listen to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. This day in labor history, the year was 1903. Labor leader Mother Mary Harris Jones was leading a march of children laborers to President Theodore Roosevelt's summer home in New York. The long march had begun 20 days before in Philadelphia. Mother Jones was hoping to draw national attention to the plight of child workers. The action caught the public's attention, and across the nation, newspapers reported on the March of the Mill Children. All the way in Leadville, a town in the mountains of Colorado west of Denver, the Herald Democrat carried the story of Mother Jones's East Coast March. The paper's July 27th article began, quote, "It is a pathetic spectacle. That little army of Mother Jones marching through the broiling heat of summer lay a petition before the president. She says truly that her errand is as vital as any which takes persons to Oyster Bay. She comes to please the cause of the child laborers, and to emphasize her protest, has with her several score of ill-clad, puny children, the result of the enforced work of these children in factories. When the children's march reached the president's door 2 days later, the president was not there to meet them. Yet the march had sparked national attention. In 1904, the National Child Labor Committee formed to take action on the issue. Pennsylvania passed tougher child labor restrictions the next year, but federal protections would have to wait until the next President Roosevelt. The passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act in 1938, signed by President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, finally included nationwide limits to child labor. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in Two.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So it looks like we're not going to get the bipartisan infrastructure bill we were told was going to happen. We were told they had 10 Republicans going to make it through cloture. We were going to get it passed. It was going to happen. I said months ago, not going to happen. I said Democrats should have taken the power that they had and just push it through budget reconciliation, get something big, get something chunky, get the investment out this summer so people's lives start getting better next year, whole electoral thing. But I also said, look, you know, we're not going to see Trump's tax returns. We're not going to see DeJoy thrown out of the Postal Service anytime soon, maybe in December. We're not going to see the moneyed interest who funded the coup attempt on January 6th. We're not going to see those things. We're certainly not going to see the Dems eliminate the filibuster or pass voting rights or the PRO Act or any of the things that I want unless we get loud, unless we get active, unless we push and demand. And even then, there's a doubt. That's why I've asked our good friend Will Bunch to come talk with us. Will is a national columnist with the Philadelphia Inquirer. He's got a great piece out this week with probably the best line that I've heard described of the Democrats. I usually go along the lines of, you know, they'll hold your coat during a street fight. But this one's better. He writes, the Democrats counter the GOP willing, a GOP willing to smash the guardrails of democracy with cautious drivers who won't veer near the double yellow lines. I don't disagree with that. Will, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, thanks for having me on again. I appreciate it, man.
You always write some of the greatest stuff. I mean, that line out of the entire piece is, I'm going, that's it. That's the money shot.
Yeah, well, we talked about that so much with Trump, right? You know, they were smashing through the guardrails, you know, and like, I don't want the Democrats to smash through the guardrails of democracy, but, you know, I don't want them driving 35 miles an hour in the center lane either, you know? I mean, that's the bottom line here. And, it applies to so much of the things that in your little monologue just now that you talked about, you know, so many of the things. There, people just want to see a Democratic Party that's going to fight for people, that's going to fight for the middle class. You know, that's in those things that you mentioned, whether it's the For the People Act, voting rights. You know, whether it's the PRO Act. You know, and the main focus of what I wrote about in my column, which is, you know, Merrick Garland, and is he going to go after some of these crimes that were committed during the Trump administration, and. You know, that they're not seeing a fighter. They're seeing institutionalists. They're seeing people who want to make sure everybody knows that they're playing by the rules. You know, when the other side is playing smash ball. And and the thing is that hurts you with the voters. You know, because what voters are looking for in the end is somebody who's going to fight for them. Voters don't care about the process. They care about results.
And that's a perfect example. Now, you know, one of the knocks that I've had about Joe Biden is he is an old school institutionalist. I mean, he's somebody who, you know, pines, I guess, for the days of Reagan and Tip O'Neill drinking whiskey and smoking cigars. And you know, days like today where George H.W. Bush signed the Americans with Disability Act. Those are past. That's not today's Republican Party. They are going to give them nothing. And today we find out. That Trump has told McConnell that he doesn't want the infrastructure bill. So surprise, surprise, it's now appearing to be on the dead track. Even though red states and blue states need investment in infrastructure like never before.
Well, you know, the bottom line, two things about that. One, first of all, I mean, nobody's surprised by this. I mean, this is exactly 2009 all over again, you know, where the Democrats spent months and months negotiating with various Republicans on some kind of health care bill. And, you know, we kind of knew then, but we definitely know now that, you know, Mitch McConnell had said he wanted Obama to be a one-term president, right? And that they never were going to do a health care bill. And so we've seen this all over again. Now, I will say there's one, but, I mean, two things could happen. It could play out exactly like that did. Well, I don't, that was complicated. We did get healthcare eventually. It was very complicated. You know, I mean, this time it could collapse altogether. Or the thing that gives me a little bit of hope is, it does seem like with this whole reconciliation track that the Democrats have kind of planned for this option, right? Possibly, we'll see. But it's possible that they could put a lot of the infrastructure stuff, and not just the obvious, the roads and bridges, but you know, some of the second level stuff like climate change, childcare stuff. You know, it's possible now that they could do some of that with reconciliation, and you know, I think with the bipartisan bill, the hope was they wanted to have their cake and eat it too. You know, that Biden could go to the voters and say, look, I told you I'd be a bipartisan president. I did get this one bill passed because it was the best I could do. And the things they wouldn't pass, I figured out how to get around them and do it. That's assuming they do that.
Yeah, but I don't know how, if you're a Republican senator, you go back to your state and go, sorry, that bridge with the weight limit that, you know, we have to shut down every once in a while, those roads with the giant chuck holes in them, you know, all of the infrastructure that we see crumbling around us. Sorry, we can't do anything because it's going to give Joe Biden a win. I don't know how you go back and do that anymore.
Well, you have to wonder if they do pass some kind of infrastructure thing through reconciliation. You have to wonder if Republicans are going to go back to their districts and just pretend that they voted for it.
Of course they will.
You know, I mean, they did that with the COVID-19 relief, basically, you know, that they tried to take credit for it after voting against it. And I mean, the thing is, I've seen some articles suggesting that kind of works with their voters, that, you know, a lot of their voters who got that $1,400 check back in the spring don't associate it with, you know, don't believe it came from Joe Biden, you know, that they want to credit Trump or they want to credit somebody else. And it's just so frustrating. And so I could imagine a scenario where the Democrats go out and do infrastructure on their own and Republican voters feel like their guys still did it, you know. But getting back to my original point, though, I mean, I think so we're going to have to see now, you know, Biden's got this $4 trillion program. How much of it are they going to try and do through reconciliation? Can they even do it? You know, can they get Joe Manchin on board? I mean, or Kyrsten Sinema? You know, we know that Joe Manchin is terrible on climate change, so that might not happen. You know, and the one thing is, they can now say, look, you know, we tried to do bipartisan, we gave these guys a chance, we negotiated with them for months, they wouldn't do it, but we had to do this for the people, so we went on and did it on their own. And I think that would be the best outcome if that happens, if they're able to do that. I've got my fingers crossed, but I don't know. I feel like this whole Biden agenda, I feel like everything could go either way at this point. I really do.
No, I mean, because Democrats are Democrats. what was it? Will Rogers said, I'm not a member of an organized party. I'm a Democrat. Yeah, there you go.
I just quoted that to somebody the other day. It's a timeless quote, isn't it?
It is a classic. It never fails to serve its purpose. But you know, the thing that gets me is, you know, I had a lot of people, you know, when Biden became president, say, you know, we're going to finally go and we're going to clean up Washington. We're going to hold, you know, the past administration accountable. And even I, knowing, even before Merrick Garland was named, knew that wasn't going to happen. We're not going to go back and you know, drag, you know, everything out about the Trump administration. We're just not. And then as soon as they named Merrick Garland, who is a very centrist jurist, he was not a radical lefty kind of judge. He was who Obama thought the Republicans, a Mitch McConnell-led Senate, would allow to get through in his last year. And that didn't happen. I knew he wasn't going to be a radical. Yeah. He wasn't going to be an activist. He wasn't going to go back. And he's proven that. He is very much not a radical.
Yeah. I mean, he believes in the rule of law, but it's kind of weird because it's kind of a weird definition of the rule of law, because, you know, in trying to play by the rules, he somehow manages to get these outcomes where he's overlooking the crimes of the most corrupt administration that America's ever had. You
yep.
know, I mean, to me, where the rubber really meets the road on this is Trump, or not, even beyond Trump, are his associates like Roger Stone, for example, or Michael Flynn, these people who seem to have been up to their eyeballs in the planning, right up to the execution of January 6th, probably, you know, in some level of conversation with Trump himself, right? You know, are these people who did the planning, are the people who provided the money for January 6th? You know, is Merrick Garland's Justice Department going to charge them, or are we just going to stop at the 800 people who, you know, fought with cops and trespassed.
Yeah, my fear is, and my fear from the beginning, Will, is right there with you, that we're going to go after the dupes who went and did the dumb things, defecated on the floor and urinated on the desk, because that's horrible and bad. And I've said from the beginning, I want to know who paid for it. I want the moneyed interest. I'm not even concerned about Roger Stone. I want to know who's funding Roger Stone. I want to know who's putting money in their pocket to organize all this stuff. Let's go after those billionaires who have created this attack machine of militia groups and right-wing fanatics that have caused this. That's where I want to go.
Sure, and that network is out there. You know, there's the Mike Lindells, the woman whose name I'm forgetting, but the
Publix.
Supermarket woman from Florida who directly funded some of this stuff. I mean, these people were funding a blatantly criminal activity, you know, interfering with a really important function of the U.S. government.
Can you imagine? Can you imagine if this was a poor person? Can you imagine what our legal system would do to somebody who couldn't fight them in court at every turn? They would go in and the asset forfeiture laws would be, you know, taking everything you'll ever have. Why don't we use asset forfeiture laws against people like Lindell and the other one?
You know, I mean, we just have a tradition in this country. I really for most of this country's history, but it seems like, especially in modern times, of elite people don't go after other elite people, no matter what party they're in. You know, it's like the fact that you guys eat lunch at the you know, near each other at the Capitol Grill, or the fact that you guys went to the same Ivy League universities, seems to matter more than right or wrong, because you know, our government is clearly capable of going after people that thinks committed crimes when you're talking about low-level people who didn't go to Ivy League schools and don't eat at the right restaurants, you know. And you know, I mean this willingness to protect people in power, and you know, I think you would agree, Rick, I mean it goes all the way back to not charging Richard Nixon and pardoning Nixon, you know. And you know, we did establish kind of a precedent in this country that you know, when a president does it, it's not illegal, which is wrong. It's not the way it should be. But, you know, we've established that precedent. And, you know, look at how many crimes were committed by Donald Trump, and look at how, you know, how slow and how hard it's been to get anything. Even the New York investigation, you know, they've been looking into this for years, and they've finally gotten to his CFO, and, you know, they've charged his company, which is great. But, you know, I mean, Donald Trump's names are all over his name is all over those transactions. Yep.
No, he's going to walk on it.
Charged yet, you know.
No, but I've been saying this, and I think you might agree as well. I mean, we've been doing this with Republican presidents my entire lifetime. Nobody went after Reagan with Iran-Contra or any of the other slew of lies and crimes that happened then. We didn't go after H.W. Bush for his involvement in a lot of that stuff. We didn't go after George W. Bush with all the lies around aluminum tubes and what got us into a war that we're still mired in. We let sleeping dogs lie because, well, we're past that now. Only to find out it keeps getting worse and worse and worse. And every time we turn a blind eye, it only gets worse the next time. So my question is, in 2024, if we end up with someone crazy like DeSantis in the White House, how bad do those crimes get? And then do we ever have a chance to go back and hold them accountable?
No, because it seems like whatever crime they commit, the line is always, we need to look forward. We can't look back. You know, the Democrats are so afraid that they'll pay some kind of political price for punishing this criminal behavior. I mean, you know, I remember this vividly during the Bush years. You know, only once during the 2008 campaign did I get a chance to directly ask Barack Obama a question. And the only thing I wanted to know was his administration going to punish people in the Bush administration who, you know, condoned torture, sent people to Gitmo, who committed all sorts of human rights violations and war crimes, frankly. And, you know, when I asked him before he was elected president, he gave me a kind of a mealy mouth on one hand, on the other hand, answer. And then when he was pressed on it again, when he was president-elect, he said, no, we're going to look forward. We're not going to look back, you know. And that just set the stage for Donald Trump, you know. I mean, you're right. It's basically gotten worse, you know, since Nixon. It's gotten pretty much worse every time. And there's never been any consequences. And, you know, the ball game is not over for Trump, but it's looking more and more like there may not be consequences for Trump. I mean, obviously, and I mean, this was because of the Republicans in the Senate, unfortunately. But I mean, he should, think how much better life would be if he had been disqualified from running in 2024.
Yeah,
You
well,
know,
think how much better it would
he
have been
could have.
had Robert Mueller done his job, and we actually impeached him and had him removed for actual crimes.
Yeah, exactly. And which brings us full circle, because this is one of Merrick Garland's things that he's doing wrong, is he won't even release the Barr memos that explain why that happened. And that I just can't find what any kind of legal, let alone political justification for basically, enabling Barr and these cover-ups. Why are you doing this other than not wanting to rock the boat, to be this like boring institutionalist? And I can't stress enough, it's just gonna, I mean, voters are gonna pick up on this, and it's gonna hurt the Democrats at the polls.
And that's my fear. You don't get the infrastructure bill pushed through. You don't pass the voting rights, so people are going to be blocked from voting. 2022 does not look like a good year unless you actually get something done. So, last question I've got real quick. Tomorrow, obviously, starting the hearings. Are you expecting anything to come out of this other than the horrible stories that we know are coming? But do you, any fall anything anyone going to jail over this outside of who we already know is going?
Again, I mean, it gets back to how high up the ladder are they going to go. I mean, it's, I really feel for these Capitol Police and what they endured. And I guess those are the first folks we're going to hear from. But, we've heard from a lot of these people already. And, we know how horrible it is. I mean, I'm glad they're establishing a record, but I hope that there's so much that we don't know still about January 6th. So to me, the question is, are they going to be able to use their powers to really dig deeper and find out, follow the money, follow the planning? What did the president know, and when did he know it? I mean, those are all the Watergate questions, right? But those are all the unanswered questions about January 6th, and when we need to know those. So whether the committee can get at any of those is going to determine whether the committee is a success or not.
There you go. Well, I appreciate the time. Hope folks will check out the piece. Merrick Garland's Elitist Caution Shows How Dems Could Become a Minority Party, written by Will Bunch over at the Philadelphia Inquirer. We'll get links out on social media. I can check that out. Will, thanks so much. As always, great stuff.
Yeah. Hey, Rick, thanks for having me on again. I appreciate it.
All right, our good friend Will Bunch. Let's take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1869. That was the day labor leader William Silvis died. Silvis was born in Armbaugh, Pennsylvania. He learned the trade of wagon making from his father, but soon he left home to take up an apprenticeship as an iron worker. He found work in Philadelphia. At the time, there was an increasing practice of iron molders to hire unskilled workers as helpers for the skilled craftsmen. This led to skilled workers seeing their wages cut. Silvis joined a strike against the wage erosion led by the Journeyman Stove and Hollowware Molders Union. Soon, he was elected secretary of the union, but Silvis understood that to truly have power, the iron molders would need to organize beyond Philadelphia. And so in 1859, 12 molders from various unions met in Philadelphia to plan to join together. The Civil War put those plans on hold. During the war, as men went to fight, many workers saw their wages increase due to the labor shortage. But prices at the stores rose even more quickly, and it became harder and harder to make ends meet. Recognizing the need for labor to organize, in 1863, Silvis helped found the Iron Molders International Union. He became the first president of the new union. 21 locals joined under the Iron Molders International Union, and it grew to include 8,000 workers. But Silvis had a bigger vision for the labor movement. He thought all skilled trades should band together to improve wages and working conditions. So in 1866, he founded the National Labor Union. The National Labor Union quickly grew to 30,000 workers. But Silvis died in 1869, cutting short his efforts to grow a national union. The union continued until 1873, when it dissolved.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.